And now here's Rick Kleffel as he speaks with John Shirley. John Shirley is all kinds of punk. In the 1970s, while playing in a punk rock band, he joined William Gibson and Bruce Sterling as the first of the cyberpunk authors. His novel City Come a Walkin' was iconic in the genre, as were his Eclipse trilogy and the short story collection Heat Seeker. His novel Cellars led the way for the splatterpunk horror authors, and his novels In Darkness Waiting and Wet Bones are high points of the genre. He was the principal screenwriter for the movie The Crow and has written extensively for movies and TV since. His fiction is rife with mythic imagery, intelligent concepts, and down-to-earth characters who live average lives. Average lives, that is, outside of confrontations with forces both supernatural and cybernetic. His latest novel is Crawlers. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi, it's good to be here.
John, tell us, what was happening back in 1978 when you decided to start writing the kind of fiction that eventually became known as cyberpunk?
Well, there was a kind of convergence of a lot of intense cultural influences at the time. There was a culture of people writing science fiction and fantasy who were tired of the old, familiar tropes of science fiction and fantasy. They wanted to do something fresh. They wanted to infuse it with the imagery of progressive writing and people like William Burroughs and beat poets and the poetry of the French surrealists and people like that, Artaud. There was this whole kind of sensibility of the demimonde that was seeping into people who were also interested in science fiction, because science fiction was a sort of alternative to mainstream literature anyway, and we just saw the possibility of kind of taking it from its kind of Isaac Asimov, direction, which is okay, but we wanted to shift it so that it had more relevance to people's lives and the immediate future.
How much communication was there between you and the other authors?
Well, we corresponded, and this was before email, and so we actually wrote print letters, if you remember those. They went in envelopes.
Vaguely.
Yeah. And, there was such a thing as epistolary literature in those days, which is dying out now because of email. But we corresponded because we'd read each other's books, and we recognized that we were part of the same culture. And there weren't very many of us. Most science fiction fans didn't know who William Burroughs is. If you said Burroughs, they thought of Edgar Rice Burroughs. And these guys knew, and they knew Hubert Selby, for example. And they were familiar also with another kind of literature, the better rock literature in the form of lyrics by the Velvet Underground, for example. They were all fans of the Velvet Underground and Pere Ubu and the seminal kind of proto-punk people like that. So we recognized each other. I mean, we stood out amongst the backdrop of the usual science fiction fantasy people, especially at conventions. We literally stood out. We were the ones dressed in black, and we had a different. We usually weren't the same geometry physically. It was like, we were the skinny ones, so we could actually see each other. Well, I shouldn't say that, but And when I met William Gibson, he's the guy who wrote Neuromancer and came up with the word cyberspace and so on a panel at a convention in Vancouver. And I, you know, this is before he'd published anything. And I started talking about, you know, kinds of fantastic fiction that were that not familiar to most science fiction people, and he was the only one on the panel who knew what I was talking about. So, you know, and then we started, you know, names started popping up, and we saw that we were both part of that culture, which is closer to the beat culture or something in those days, and then what became the punk culture. And, you know, we were like instantly cronies, and after the panel, and, you know, found ourselves sort of like in the same foxhole, in a sense.
From this background of beat culture and surrealist poetry, how did you choose the computer and its influence on society, or how did that come to be the central core of the imagery that dominates cyberpunk and much of fiction today?
Computer?
The computer.
Well...
In the network, in the internet, the idea of an electronic communication.
I guess because the famous phrase, I'm not even sure where it originates. Gibson, I think, quotes it, the street has its own uses for things. And you could see that people, you know, at a street level were reaching for some way to express themselves that wasn't yet co-opted. And there was just the beginnings. There was the beginnings of the PC revolution, you know, in the late 70s and into the 80s and stretching into the early 90s and the beginnings of the internet and the well. For example, a lot of these people knew each other from the well, which is like the first kind of one of the first internet chat room things or, you know.
That's a San Francisco creation. Could you talk a little bit about the well?
Well, I wasn't really that involved, but Sterling and Gibson and a lot of these people were. It's, you know, it was like a prototypical kind of message board communication center in the early days of the internet. And a lot of these people, like from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, were part of that scene. And they all knew each other. There was a lot of overlap and cultural mutual insemination from through the well, and people saw the potential of that, and there was a sort of sense of the leveling and the democratizing of society that could potentially come through computers and computer technology. It empowered people, you know, there was also the counterculture at that time, where people were looking for empowerment for the, you know, outside of the mainstream, supposedly imperialistic culture. You know, we were all reacting to the Vietnam War, so we were looking for different ways of empowering, and computer technology seemed to offer that, and all of us were sort of fascinated by street culture, including things like the black market and drug dealing, and we didn't do it, but we knew about it, and all of our friends were somehow involved or knew somebody who did, and we saw that was itself its own kind of revolution. You know, it was because it was people becoming independent and flying under the radar through you know, whatever means they could find, get their hands on, and just take command of. Cyberpunk had that quality of, you know, of powerful individualism on the street level. You see that in stories like Johnny Mnemonic, you know, where people take technology and they twist it to their own weird individualistic purposes.
Could you talk a little bit about the interplay for you and for the field between music and fiction?
Well, sort of instinctive, visceral thing with me. I grew up listening to rock and roll and folk music, and all of my early stories usually had a little segment of in the story that was lyrics that was where I was trying to make up lyrics from some imaginary band and seamlessly weave it into the prose of the story. And sometimes I would try and reproduce the rhythms of music in the prose I was writing. And it just was instinctive with me. And very early on, I was also in rock bands and punk bands. I started the first punk bands in Portland, Oregon. Really, some of the first two or three in the Pacific Northwest.
Also, one thing that you and your fiction seems to be interested in is shock value. You have the shock of the new with your cyberpunk, and to a certain extent, the shock of the old with your horror. Could you talk about fiction that shocks, that jolts people out of their complacency?
Well, it's what you said. We're trying to jolt them out of their complacency. We recognize, you know, this kind of vast hypnotizing influence of media and ordinary popular culture. And we looked around us and saw the suburbs sprawling out around us. The little piece that you played was called Johnny Paranoid, right? And then from the same band, my band Sado Nation, there was one called Condominium Nightmare. And it kind of expresses that feeling of that, you know, you find yourself installed without anybody having asked you into this vast pattern that you never asked for, a kind of social wallpaper, and you're just a little Philip in the social wallpaper. And you look around yourself and see this, and you feel helpless. And so, you know, you want to get out, and you want to shake other people up and let them know, look, we're stuck in this thing. We can make our own patterns. We can make our own, culture. We don't have to accept being force-fed this culture. But to do that, you first have to shake them up and shock them out of their complacency, at least theoretically.
These days, in your recent fiction, you really show a lot of empathy for suburban residents. Your recent novel, Crawlers, and In Darkness Waiting, both featured some really well-rounded, convincing, and sympathetic suburban characters. Tell us how you've gone from being installed to being inspired by the suburbs.
Well, I live there. It's where I was able to buy a house. I've got a family. But it's possible to live any place in an awake sort of way and to dehypnotize yourself wherever you are. And I look around me wherever I am and live. And, I'm a writer and describe what I see. A lot of my stories previously were about inner city and urban scenes because that's where I lived. I lived in the Lower East Side in New York City for many years, and I lived in San Francisco itself, and I was trying to evoke that. And now I live in the suburbs, and I'm trying to see beyond the surface of where I live in both cases. Because there's always a life there that you don't normally see, and it's easy to just sort of skate by and not notice it. If you go to the suburbs on a typical day, you'll see a few people cutting their lawn, but for the most part, you don't see anyone. They're behind these polarized windows, you know. They're in their backyard barbecuing with a few select friends. But it's not like the life of a European city or a big city back east on the street where people are all thronging the sidewalks and interacting with each other. It's very curtained away. And so what's going on behind the curtains? What's, you know, what is the secret life in a suburb? And in Crawlers, I try to bring that out, and then I fuse it with the allegorical material that is taken from the fantastic, from science fiction imagery, but which really is just sort of playing out that secret life symbolically.
Talk a little bit, too, about your idea of the good apocalypse. I really was intrigued by that. You get a little bit of that in Silicon Embrace, and you have some plans for some positive apocalyptic novels, don't you?
Yeah, I have one that I'd like to write, if I can intrigue a publisher or find the time to simply take the chance on it, called The Other End. And it's called that for a couple of reasons. We have these apocalyptic novels out that were bestsellers by Christian fundamentalists.
Oh, yeah, the Left Behind series.
Yeah, and, you know, I haven't read deeply into them. I've read through them as much as you can standing in the bookstore. But I got a sense of them, and I've read reviews, and I know where they're coming from. And it's a very literalistic interpretation of Revelation, which actually is kind of absurd since, you know, biblical historians know that the book of Revelations was actually about the Roman Empire and was actually projecting only about 50 years from the time it was written. It was not intended to write, you know, about something happening 2,000 years later. It was about Rome. But then they... You know, because of the Rorschach inkblot, you know, phenomena, you can see what you want in a pattern. You know, people will superimpose their interpretation of that text on our own time and society in the service of their oppressive interpretation of religion. Very narrow. You know, in my opinion, foolish because it's, you know, of the creationist aspect, especially that sort of thing. So, you know, but what if there was another kind of apocalypse? What if there was a good apocalypse rather than a big, judgmental, cruel apocalypse that simply set the world, you know, back into kilter again and entity of some kind? You know, which we conveniently label God, realizes that this planet has, you know, not been supervised properly. Somebody was asleep at the switch, you know, and he comes back and, oh my gosh, look at this stuff that's happened. The Dark Ages, actually, that wasn't intended. Somebody was supposed to prevent that. You know, the Inquisition, I'm sorry, I'm so embarrassed. You know, the Holocaust, oh, you know, and so this entity, you know, shakes up the world and transforms it back into more or less, you know, what was originally intended, which was a reasonable balance of you know, the dark and light elements, and wakes people up so that they can, you know, get outside of their sort of mechanical psychological programming. And, it, you know, it's a very subjective what's going to happen in the book according to my particular, you know, political and social perspective. You know, it's going to be unapologetically my take on what God should do if he comes back. You know, so I get to play God in the book. And it's going to be very much a contrast to those Left Behind books. It's The Other End.
You've worked a lot with small press publishers, Mark Zeesing, who's a publisher and a bookseller, Cemetery Dance and Nightshade, and you've also published with big publishers, Crawlers is Del Rey. I'm wondering if you'd care to comment on the intersection of art and commerce in both music and literature.
Well, it's becoming more and more evident, the impact of commerce on art. You can see, if you look at what's been happening in publishing, the publishing companies are being bought by enormous multinational conglomerates, oil companies, you know, vast, big, soulless, mindless oil companies own publishing companies that used to be independent, and their values, their corporate values, are kind of shifting the way publishing is carried out, so that people are far more quick profit oriented than ever before. And publishing was always a business, but there was a place in it for cultivating writers, and that kind of like middle ground of cultivation is now an excluded middle and is becoming lost as they go more and more toward novelizations and formulaic material and things that have to become bestsellers or else they're discarded. There's very little development of an author anymore, and you can find some, you know, you can find niche literary activities happening in it, but it's increasingly narrow, in my opinion, and the established publishers do it less and less and less. And probably something of the same is happening in music. Music is in such a ferment now because of the internet and that whole phenomena and downloading. It's hard to see where that's going to go right now. They are recognizing that people have a built-up resentment because they were ripped off on the price of CDs. They actually admitted in court recently that they had overcharged for CDs, for example. And you can get a $20 check to, you know, ameliorate your feeling of being ripped off a little bit if you go to this certain website that all these record companies contribute to. And there's this just general sense of resentment against that whole industry, so that people feel, you know, it's okay to download stuff and to pirate music. And they know that. So they're going to have to find, another way to sell music that it seems fair to the public, and just recognize this kind of new economy emerging, and find another way to make a profit. And it's hard to imagine exactly how they're going to do it. They're tearing out their hair trying to figure it out. But it's like a real clash, though, between corporate culture and the democratic instincts of the common person. You know, I'm not sure where it's going, but it's funny to watch them flail around right now.
Your new novel, Crawlers, feeds quite a bit off the paranoia of not trusting the government.
Well, the founding fathers didn't trust the government they were creating. They kept, writing in warnings about not trusting the government. Hamilton and Jefferson and people like that, and they warned people that this thing was liable to develop into a behemoth that would get out of control. I think it's very American to mistrust the government, and it's patriotic to mistrust the government, indeed, because it exerts a pressure on the government to constantly evolve. It's, you know, it's part of the pressure for the evolution and the kind of development of intelligence in a government when people are suspicious of it and keep prodding and pushing and demanding, you know, that it expose itself. And I think it's healthy, actually, rather than paranoia. One of my sayings is that paranoia is a skill. You know, you have to be intelligent about paranoia, and there are people with ridiculous conspiracy theories, but some conspiracies are real. I mean, people should be skeptical toward any system that controls their lives behind shadows, where they can't see what's going on.
I'm wondering if you would talk a little bit about being a working artist.
Well, I'm a freelance guy, and it alternates between being heaven and hell. I mean, I can get up at 10:30 in the morning if I want to, and often do. And I can, set my own hours, but it's also means that I'm when you're a real freelance artist, cash flow is uneven. You're constantly hustling for a new gig, and I've done very well, but it does lack that kind of fundamental solidity of a day job. So it can be hard. So it's both things, you know. It's constant anxiety, and it's like sort of like being a fisherman. You know, you have to constantly keep lines in the water, and some years the catch isn't good. But there's nobody else around you, you know, telling you what to do all day. You're out there at sea, and there's a certain freedom.
Could you tell us what's coming up, both in books and in film, since you're writing for film and TV?
Well, I'm working on a book called Jesus the Gnostic, which is about... It's not a humorous book. You're laughing here. It's a serious book, but it's about it's a novel about Jesus as a Gnostic, as a because I believe he was a Gnostic, and the Gospel of Thomas probably represents his real teaching, a very radical sort of teaching too, and very mystical. And it's sort of Jesus being influenced by Buddhists, because there were Buddhists around at the time, and I think he may have run into them, and by the Essenes, and creating what became Gnosticism, of which there's just a little bit in the Bible. There's no resurrection in it. The Gnostics held that he was crucified but survived, just didn't die, that there was a deception, and that he was taken down before he was dead and survived and basically moved out of the area. And that's basically what I'm going to say in a novelistic form. And I'm writing spec screenplays. That one is called Jump Out, and it's based on my short story War and Peace. From Black Butterflies, my story collection, Black Butterflies. It's a suspense piece.
We've been speaking with John Shirley. His latest novel is Crawlers. Thanks, John.
It was great.